Chapter 5 Playing Ball with Socrates. Material things are indifferent, but how we handle them is not indifferent. Epictetus, Discourses, Book 2, Chapter 5. When we talked about living according to nature in the previous chapter, I mentioned that the Stoics had a fondness for pithy summaries of their philosophy. I find this to be an endearing aspect of their thinking, for a couple of reasons. First, it is a forceful reminder that they were interested in practice, not just theory. Their aphorisms were meant to benefit the Procopton, that is, to help the student of Stoicism make progress. Unlike modern bumper stickers, t-shirt slogans, and so forth, which primarily signal membership in a particular group and tend to be used as a metaphorical club with which to beat those who are not like-minded, Stoic stock phrases were employed by practitioners as personal reminders, as aids for daily meditation, or as a guide to behavior when they were in doubt. Stoicism, in other words, was not meant to be worn on your sleeve, unless you were someone, say a teacher, who couldn't avoid doing so. Marcus Aurelius carried this attitude to the extreme. His famous Meditations were written as a personal diary of reflection, not as a book meant for publication, and in antiquity, the work was known as ta es houten, which simply means to himself. I also like Stoic aphorisms because these short sentences are often superficially paradoxical and can be taken in one of two ways. On the one hand, as a perennial source of frustration, since the Stoic must constantly explain herself to others who keep misunderstanding what her philosophy is about, and on the other hand, as an opportunity for a teaching moment. Asked about one of these paradoxes, the Stoic has the perfect opening to move from the bumper sticker level to at least the level of an elevator speech, which seems to be the most that much modern conversation allows, be it in person or on social media. Perhaps the most paradoxical of these phrases is preferred indifference and dispreferred indifference. Since the category indifferent pretty much encompasses everything outside of an individual's excellence of character or virtue, then we better get clear on what exactly the Stoics meant by this. As usual, I asked Epictetus to clarify, this time during a nice walk in the Casal Palocco area of Rome, where there happens to be a street named after him. That surprised the hell out of my friend, who is very modest by nature. As he often does, he referred me to Socrates, who was a major influence on Stoic thought. Socrates was like one playing at ball. What then was the ball that he played with life? Life, imprisonment, exile, taking poison, being deprived of his wife, leaving his children orphans. These were the things he played with, but nonetheless, he played and tossed the ball with balance. So we ought to play the game, so to speak, with all possible care and skill, but treat the ball itself as indifferent. Let me unpack this analogy, which is clearly between one's life and playing ball. I'm not sure which game Epictetus was referring to, but let's say it was Greco-Roman soccer. The point of the analogy is that the ball itself, though central to the game and apparently the focus of everyone's attention, is actually indifferent, meaning that it could take a variety of colors and shapes, be made of different materials, or be of different sizes, but it isn't valuable in itself. The ball is only a means to an end, and isn't the important thing. It is what one does with the ball that defines the game, how well it is played, and who wins or loses. Indeed, a good player does not have rigid ideas about how to handle the ball, when or to whom to pass it, and so on. The best players are those who display fantasia, creativity, who are imaginative about what they do on the field, and who find new ways to turn difficult situations to their favor, making the obstacle the way, to paraphrase Marcus Aurelius. Moreover, the hallmark of an admirable player isn't that he wins games, but that he plays his best regardless of the final outcome, which, after all, is not under his control. Likewise with Socrates, fate handed him certain materials to play with, including the time and place of his birth, the political system and situation of Athens in the 5th century BCE, and so forth. He strove to live a good life, doing his military duty during the Peloponnesian War and teaching his fellow citizens about philosophy. When Meletus, with the shady support of Anytus and Lycon, accused him of impiety, that is, not believing in the state's official gods, he stood in front of his fellow citizens to argue his case, even though it was clear that the charges stemmed from a combination of political and personal vendettas on the part of his accusers. After he was condemned to death by the tribunal of the people, Socrates had an easy opportunity to escape, thanks to his friends, who were more than willing to bribe the guards, a rather common practice, and not only in those times. Instead, he turned the occasion into an explanation of his duties toward the city that had given him birth and nurtured him his whole life. In Plato's Crito, Socrates tells his distraught friends that he has a moral duty to accept the law even when it is patently misused, because we don't get to change the rules when they happen not to suit us. He is therefore willing to take the poison and leave his friends, students, wife, and child in order not to compromise his integrity, which is the important thing. All else is indifferent, not in the sense that Socrates didn't care about his friends and family, or for that matter, his own life, but in the deeper sense that he was not willing to compromise his virtue in order to save his skin, or even to spare his loved one's suffering. As Epictetus told me during our conversation, how do I know what is going to turn up? My business is to use what does turn up with diligence and skill. It is for you, then, to take what is given you and make the most of it. A modern-day analogy may be made here with the American whistleblower Edward Snowden. As is well known, Snowden was a contractor for the U.S. National Security Agency. In 2013, he released a number of classified documents that exposed a broad and arguably illegal surveillance system enacted by the NSA, which has since led to a much-needed debate on the balance between surveillance and democratic values in an open society. Predictably, the very mention of Snowden tends to generate polarized responses, just as Socrates' name did in his time. For some, he is a hero. For others, a traitor. And in fact, he may well be considered both. Quite irrespectively of whether what Snowden did was morally right or not, again, similar to the question of whether Socrates' teachings and political actions were right or not, we can reasonably wonder about the ethics of Snowden seeking asylum abroad, at the moment of this writing in Russia, of all places. Rather than facing the two charges of violating the 1917 Espionage Act that the U.S. government has leveled against him. I honestly do not know the answer. Socrates decided to stay, and Snowden decided not to return. But even if you think that Snowden should have faced the consequences, right or not, of his actions, we can all probably agree that few people have risen to the moral stature of Socrates, which is why he is one of the standard role models used by Stoics. Luckily, most of us will not face the morally treacherous terrain on which Socrates and Snowden found themselves. Nonetheless, we have plenty of opportunities to decide how to play the ball thrown in our directions of life. Let me give you a couple of trivial examples. Not long after my conversation with Epictetus, I happened to need some cash for personal expenses, so I went around the corner from my apartment in New York, accessed the ATM of the local branch of my bank, and got the money. And then I froze in my tracks. You see, if you hang around Stoics, you soon discover that everything has an ethical dimension. In this case, I suddenly remembered that my bank had notoriously been involved in a number of shady practices. For example, questionable investments and financial tools, directed toward both their own employees and society at large. That meant that my preferred indifferent, being able to conveniently get cash from my account whenever I need it, was actually in tension with my implicit support of labor and social practices that I oppose in principle. Oops. As a result of that reflection, I walked into the bank's branch and explained to a baffled customer representative that I was closing my account. Not because I was dissatisfied with the level of service, which was actually excellent, but because I had irreconcilable differences with the bank about how they were using what was, after all, my money. I then did some research and found a bank that, though most certainly not ethically impeccable, was unquestionably better than the one I had just ditched. I brought my business to them, and I have been feeling a little better ever since. Similarly, I grew up a complete omnivore in Italy, with parents and grandparents who couldn't really wrap their minds around the word vegetarian. I am not a vegetarian even today, but I've gradually started paying more attention to where my food comes from and at what cost in terms of animal suffering, environmental impact, and human labor. It is a complex problem with no easy solution and plenty of conflicts among distinct indifference. For instance, contra to the standard vegetarian argument, it is not at all easy to calculate just how many animals suffer and die when you take up a vegetarian diet, because large-scale cultivation of plant species for human consumption radically alters the environment of the planet, depriving a number of wild animal species of vital ecological space. If you think that eating local and organic is sustainable, you may be in for a surprise when you look at the relevant literature or do a bit of back-of-the-envelope calculation. Even the activist journalist Michael Pollan, author of the best-selling The Omnivore's Dilemma, A Natural History of Four Meals, agrees that we cannot feed billions of people on the kind of diet that he and I can afford and easily find at our local green grocery shops. Then again, to argue that we have a right to eat whatever we fancy, regardless of the demonstrably immense levels of suffering and environmental damage we inflict in the process, seems more than a bit callous. This dilemma is probably why a number of Stoics were in fact vegetarian. Take Seneca, who wrote that, "I was imbued with this vegetarian teaching and began to abstain from animal food. At the end of the year, the habit was as pleasant as it was easy. I was beginning to feel that my mind was more active." Seneca eventually abandoned vegetarianism because he did not want to be associated with a particular political faction that had adopted the practice. Was he then just an opportunist, or at the very least morally weak? Not necessarily. We do not know the details. But he may have calculated that sticking to a vegetarian diet would have done less good for the world, which for him meant, of course, Roman society, than choosing to differentiate himself from that particular political party. Being vegetarian, in and of itself, is no proof of superior moral quality. But it is a good thing to do if other considerations do not outweigh that choice. And it is the hallmark of a wise person to be able to navigate a complex situation otherwise characterized by no easily identifiable optimal course of action. Musonius Rufus, Epictetus's teacher, was famous for being a particularly practical Stoic who gave his students advice on everything from the important things in life, such as the idea that women ought to get the same education as men, to somewhat trivial matters, like how to furnish your house efficiently with stuff that doesn't break easily, or cut your hair, removing only what is useless. He had a lot to say about diet, too. He argued that although there are many pleasures which persuade human beings to do wrong and compel them to act against their own interests, the pleasure connected with food is undoubtedly the most difficult of all pleasures to combat, adding, "To obtain those few moments of gastronomic pleasure, countless expensive foods must be prepared and brought overseas from distant lands. Cooks are more highly valued than farmers. Some people spend all their possessions to have their banquets prepared, but they are not made stronger by eating these expensive foods. When it comes to food, responsible people favor what is easy to obtain over what is difficult, what involves no trouble over what does, and what is available over what isn't." Now this strikes very close to home for me, and it is an excellent example of how the Stoics saw life preferred indifference. As I mentioned, I grew up in Rome and live in New York. Indeed, I am writing this book during a sabbatical from my home institution, a leave of absence that I'm spending in the Eternal City, partly to get inspired by almost daily walks to the Colosseum, the Forum, and other sites, but partly to enjoy the company of my family and, yes, the delicious food my hometown readily offers. My partner and I also take advantage of all the good restaurants in the Big Apple, including a number of expensive ones where the cooks are definitely better paid than the farmers, and where to obtain a few moments of gastronomic pleasure, countless expensive foods must be prepared and brought overseas from distant lands. It seems like my choices at this point are rather limited and somewhat unpleasant. Either I should frankly admit that for all this talk about Stoicism, I'm actually an Epicurean, in the modern small e sense of the word, and therefore a hypocrite, or I should give up fine dining in the name of logical consistency, thus relegating myself to what others may consider a joyless life while surrounded by culinary pleasures of all kinds in which I refuse to partake. But one of the first things you learn if you study philosophy is that there rarely is such a thing as a sharp dichotomy in any but the more trivial matters. In fact, when I teach informal logic, I warn my students that more often than not, if someone is presenting them with just one of two forced choices, that person is probably committing what is called the fallacy of false dichotomy. He's not telling them that other options are available. Of course, in some cases, there really are only two options, and being forced to face a narrow choice is no logical error, but the general point holds. In this case, for instance, cheap, delicious, and healthy meals can be found in Rome, prepared by local cooks using seasonally available ingredients, thus satisfying Musonius's requirements. It is also possible to find such meals in New York, of course, but there the temptation to splurge on seriously, perhaps outrageously, expensive meals, which are far better described as culinary experiences, is great. That is where I decided to draw the line. Within limits, I told my partner and my closest friends that I'd rather not go to, say, 11 Madison Park, if it could be avoided. Which, of course, is possible most of the time. But not all of the time. If a dear friend or my companion were to tell me that once in a lifetime they really want to have the 11 Madison Park experience, say to celebrate a very special occasion, and would be greatly disappointed if I didn't join them, I might consider it. That's not hypocrisy or rationalization, I think, but rather a balancing of competing demands that stem from different ethical criteria. Supporting a type of operation which I do not approve versus disappointing someone I love. Remember that I am using the Greco-Roman understanding of ethics, which had a much broader meaning than the modern word. The reasonable thing to do, and Stoics were all about applying reason to everyday affairs, might be to compromise. Yes, we'll go this one time, but we'll make up for it in some fashion, like doubling our efforts to patronize locally sourced and environmentally and labor-friendly eateries for the rest of the year. Will I feel uncomfortable during that evening of celebration? Probably, but as the Emperor Marcus Aurelius said, and he wasn't kidding or being sarcastic, if you must live in a palace, then you can also live well in a palace. Generally speaking, then, Stoic ethics isn't just about what we do, our actions, but more broadly about how our character is equipped to navigate real life. We live in far too intricate social environments to be able to always do the right thing, or even to do the right thing often enough to know with sufficient confidence what the right thing is to begin with. Most of the different demands made on us have an ethical dimension, animal suffering, environmental damage, the treatment of waiters, but some are also more practical. I need to eat, but where is my food coming from? I need to bank, but which bank am I supporting? Stoicism is about developing the tools to deal as effectively as humanly possible with the ensuing conflicts, does not demand perfection, and does not provide specific answers. Those are for fools, Epictetus's word, who think the world is black and white, good versus evil, where it is always possible to clearly tell the good guys from the bad guys. That is not the world we live in, and to pretend otherwise is more than a bit dangerous and not at all wise. That said, let me return to the idea of indifference and their classification as preferred or dispreferred by contrasting Stoicism with two other important Hellenistic schools of thought, Aristotelianism and Cynicism, the latter being a word that, even more so than Stoicism and Epicureanism, has a different meaning today than it did then, which is why I capitalize the words in reference to the philosophies and lowercase them otherwise. Aristotle was a student of Plato, and hence a grand student of Socrates, so to speak, and his philosophy was characterized by a very practical, if somewhat elitist, approach. In his version of virtue ethics, a eudaimonic life is possible by the pursuit of virtue, but we also need many other things over which we have no control: health, wealth, education, and even good looks. Contrast this with the thinking of the first cynic, Antisthenes, himself a student of Socrates. Antisthenes, and even more so his famous successor, Diogenes of Sinope, went radical. For them, nothing is necessary for a eudaimonic life except virtue. We may be healthy or sick, wealthy or poor, educated or ignorant, handsome or ugly. None of it matters. Indeed, they went so far as to argue that earthly possessions positively get in the way of virtue. They develop in us an attachment to things that don't matter, so we are better off without them. Diogenes seriously practiced what he preached. His lifestyle could be characterized as in-your-face ascetic, as he made a show of sleeping in a tub in the streets of Athens, defecating and copulating in public, hence the term cynic, which means dog-like, and carrying little or nothing for his own survival and comfort. There are wonderful stories about Diogenes. One tells us that he was thirsty one day, and so pulled out a bowl while approaching some running water. He then saw a boy helping himself to the water by simply cupping his hands to hold the liquid. Diogenes threw away his bowl in disgust, muttering that even a boy was wiser than him. On another occasion, he was visited by Alexander the Great, who had heard of the famous philosopher and went to pay his respects, presumably in front of the tub. When Alexander magnanimously, or so he thought, asked Diogenes what he, the most powerful man in the world, could do on behalf of the philosopher, the latter looked up and said something along the lines of, "You could move, you are blocking my sun." That ought to give you an idea of why the cynics were both much admired and much despised. Now, here is the problem. On the one hand, we have Aristotle telling us that eudaimonia can be achieved only by somewhat lucky people who fit a number of prerequisites, acquired through little or no merit of their own. On the other hand, we've got the cynics, not only rejecting Aristotle's list of necessary prerequisites, but arguing that they get in the way of a good life. Stoics occupy the logical space in between these two positions. Health, wealth, education, and good looks, among other things, are preferred indifference, while their opposites, and a number of other things, are dispreferred indifference. This, I think, was a stroke of genius. The Stoics made a eudaimonic life a reachable goal for everyone, regardless of social status, financial resources, physical health, or degree of attractiveness. Although all of these qualities are indifferent to your ability to pursue a virtuous life, to become a morally worthy person, they are still preferred, just as any normal human being would readily tell you, so long as they don't get in the way of your practice of the virtues. Here is how Seneca aptly summarized the idea in the case of a particularly common contrast between preferred and dispreferred experiences. "There is great difference between joy and pain. If I am asked to choose, I shall seek the former and avoid the latter. The former is according to nature, the latter contrary to it. So long as they are rated by this standard, there is a great gulf between. But when it comes to a question of the virtue involved, the virtue in each case is the same, whether it comes through joy or through sorrow." In other words, by all means, go ahead and avoid pain and experience joy in your life, but not when doing so imperils your integrity. Better to endure pain in an honorable manner than to seek joy in a shameful one. There is a way to understand this point in very modern parlance, using the language of economic theory, of all things. Economists have developed the concept of lexicographic preferences, so called because they work in a fashion similar to the ordering of words in a dictionary to describe situations where people want incommensurable goods. That is, goods that cannot be compared to each other in terms of value. Let's say that I value goods 1 and 2, which belong to category A, but also goods 3, 4, and 5, which belong to category B. While 1 and 2 can be compared and contrasted, and the same goes for 3, 4, and 5, no good belonging to A is comparable to any good belonging to B, and anything from A has complete precedence over anything from B. The result is that goods can be traded within either A or B, but not across these categories. Here, the pursuit of virtue is in category A, while the preferred indifference are in category B. Within B, you may well trade things off. Money for education, a good career for family life, and so forth. But for a Stoic, there is no trade-off between A and B. Nothing can be traded if the price is the compromising of your character. This, incidentally, means that there are contrasts between goods, such as virtue versus physical health, to which standard economic theory simply does not apply. This may sound strange, but a moment's reflection will show that we all already use lexicographic indexing for many of our choices. You might like, say, the idea of going on vacation in a nice resort in the Caribbean. And because going on vacation and spending money are on the same lexicographical level, you are willing to trade off some of your hard-earned money in order to achieve that goal. But I assume that you wouldn't sell your daughter for any purpose at all, and certainly not just to enjoy a vacation. That's because your daughter belongs to a higher lexicographic level, one that is incommensurable with vacations, as pleasant and needed as the latter may be. Regardless of whether we express it in philosophical or economic terms, this Stoic concept is quite empowering. If you follow Aristotle, and let's be frank, a lot of what passes for common sense, you need to be part of the lucky elite or you won't have a good life. This outlook puts most people on the perennially losing side of things, condemning them to the pursuit of material goods because they mistakenly think that their happiness and worth depend on acquiring them. Psychologists call this the hedonic treadmill. You keep running, but you ain't going nowhere. By contrast, everyone can have a good life according to the cynics, but few of us are inclined to spend it living in a tub and defecating in the streets. The Stoic compromise, their lexicographic contrast between the virtues and the preferred indifference, coupled with their treatment of the two as hierarchically ordered incommensurable classes of goods, brilliantly overcomes the problem, retaining the best of both philosophical worlds.